What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine.
Thank you for being here. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. And today I have a guest who I've been trying to get on the podcast for quite some time, Thief Sutton. Now, you have seen that name on television for years. You've seen it on the big screen. You've seen it at your bookstore, if you still happen to have a bookstore. Thief Sutton, and of course he pronounces his name Thief and spells it P-H-O-E-F, is really a Renaissance man. He worked with me for years on Cheers. Eventually, he became one of the showrunners of Cheers. He did a series for Bob Newhart. He turned his attention to drama and was on Boston Legal. Also did Terriers, which was a very underappreciated show. He also did movies. In fact, he wrote a film for Robert De Niro, which turned out not to be so good. And then he made another transition and became a mystery novelist and has collaborated with Janet Ivanovich, also has his own series of mystery novels. This guy has done it all. And I sat down and spoke with Thief Sutton, and we talked and talked and talked, and there's so much there that I'm going to break it up into two parts so that I just don't overwhelm you with it. Part one, we are going to talk a lot about television comedy and his life in sitcoms and how he got that rather unusual name. So stick around. Part one, my interview with Thief Sutton.
Hollywood and Levine.
Okay, the first question I want to ask you is probably the first question that everybody asks you. The name Thief, where does that come from? How did you get the name Thief?
Well, I wish I had a good story. I wish I had a good... For a while, I told people it was an old Irish family name. But actually, it was a nickname that my brothers gave me before I could talk. They used to play a game, and I would be sitting in my high chair, and they'd be knights of the round table, and I was the king, and I was King Thief.
Okay.
And because of all the friends that I knew and was close to in high school and junior high school and all that were mostly through them, they continued to call me Thief. And everybody called me Thief, and eventually my parents started calling me Thief. And I became Thief. That was my name. And
P-H-O-E-F?
Yeah, the spelling.
That's the normal spelling of Thief? The spelling came later.
Well, you know, Phoenix, Phoebe.
Right.
It makes sense. I don't know. The nice thing about it is that when you get courtesy calls at home and people ask for Robert Sutton, which is my real first name, uh-huh, I know that it's nobody I know, because nobody calls me Robert. Nobody calls me Bob. My father even gave up on it. And it's an interesting name because people, you see it on the screen, they remember it. They don't know if I'm a man or a woman. It sticks in people's minds.
I guess when you go to souvenir shops and things, you know, and they have license plates with people's names and mugs and stuff like that, Coke bottles, you know.
You never see a Thief. No, I've never run across another Thief. I keep waiting for someone to name their child Thief after me, that's an interesting name, Thief. And of course, nobody can pronounce it. If they see it written, they call me Thief and Thief and Thief.
Right.
Thief. But it's my name.
Well, you are so prolific in so many genres, and I want to kind of go through it. Did you always want to be a writer? It seems like you did, even as a kid.
As a kid, I wanted to be a writer. I remember when I was like, before I was in the first grade, I got a typewriter. My parents had a typewriter.
Right.
And I typed out the book Hop on Pop. Remember that Dr. Seuss book, Hop on Pop?
Yeah.
I typed that out and thought, I've written a book, you know. So, I mean, I always wanted to write a book, and I wrote short stories in high school. There were like mystery horror short stories that I would send into Alfred Hitchcock Presents and Playboy and all those magazines that published short stories in those days. And I had all the rejection slips on my bulletin board, and I was very proud of them, and never got one accepted. Then when I was in...
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, in outside of Washington, D.C. My dad worked for the government. He worked for the IRS. I don't like to.
That's why you changed your name to Feef.
Yes. I got into theater in high school and college, and so I acted, and I started writing plays because, you know, I put on in the little black box theater they had there, and so that was my first foray into writing for, you know, dramatic, for actors to read. And I was in plays that I wrote, which is a wonderful experience, because you really can't blame anybody if it doesn't work. You can't say, who the fuck wrote this, or well, the actor just screwed it up, you know, you're doing it all. And And it was a great training, of course, for later on when I got onto Cheers, because, you know, that was basically a play. I mean, you were writing, you know, it was one set.
One-act play, yeah.
Entrances, exits, all that stuff. That, you know, and I didn't know a lot of other writers who had written plays. And I had regional theaters did my plays around the country. You know, if they give you a $300 stipend that you never get, actually, mm-hmm. for gas money, and then, but still, it's a play, they're putting it on, and, you know, in Minnesota and Washington, D.C., and the Valley, and, you know, it was a really cool learning
what
learning
brought experience. You to Los Angeles?
Well, I wanted to be a writer. I went to graduate school, I went to college at James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Then I went to graduate school at the University of Florida, where I met my wife. But it was, I like to say, it was the rest of the faculty from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. You know, they were so screwed up. All the teachers were so screwed up and all that sort of thing that I didn't finish, you know. And I thought, well, I should just try to be a writer. I should try to be a writer and an actor. And so I moved to New York, and there was a brief flurry of interest in a play that I'd written. Ulu Grosbard was going to direct it, and it was like, oh, it's great, and then it went away. And that I discovered was the pattern of my career, of everybody's career. You know, there's always some great thing that's going to happen. Yeah. Oh, my God, this is going to change. And it goes away. And sometimes, once or twice, it actually happens. Yeah. It actually happens. But the rest of the time, you know, you have to embrace failure, you know? You have to embrace that you're going to get kicked in the teeth and again and again and again and again. And so I couldn't really get into New York. I mean, I couldn't find an apartment, I couldn't find a job. And my brother worked in the Crown bookstore chain, and they had bookstores in Los Angeles. So I knew that I could go and get at least a job in Los Angeles. And my wife, her aunt was oddly married to Don Knotts at the time.
Wow.
And so I could, you know, stay in Don Knotts' house till we got an apartment. So, yeah, this is cool. He's a really nice guy.
Uh-huh.
Great guy. He ended up straying from the marriage.
Oh.
So I lost him in the divorce. But he was a really nice guy. I got an apartment, you know, of course, right off Hollywood Boulevard, and spent...
First stop, L.A.
Three, four years, yeah. You know, trying to get an agent, trying to get a writer, working in a bookstore, writing scripts at night. I didn't know about anything about how to get into the business, so I wrote screenplays, you know. Yeah, that's a great thing to do. And then one of my one of my college friends was Barbara Hall, who was writing then for Newhart.
Right.
She's gone.
She's
on
now, yeah, Madam Secretary. Success.
She does Madam Secretary. She's a great writer. But at this time, she was writing for Newhart, and she told me about writing a spec script. So I wrote a spec script for Newhart, and it got into the office, and then she and everybody that she knew on the staff left the show. So it was in the office, but nobody who knew me from Adam was there to read it.
Right.
Cut to 3 years later, I got a call. For some reason, somebody read the script and liked it. And by then, the entire supporting cast in Newhart had changed. You remember they did that.
So your script itself.
So the script itself
was
irrelevant. But they thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
So they took me to lunch. They said, "We don't have a job. We don't have any scripts to give you." But they took me to lunch, which was good because at this point, my wife was 3 months pregnant, and we had like $32 in a checking account, and we're going crazy. But I guess that interested Barbara's agent enough that he sent it to Heidi Perlman at Cheers and probably other places too. Heidi Perlman read it, liked it, passed it around. Everybody liked the Newhart script. They brought me in and to pitch. And I had no idea how to pitch and did a terrible job. And they must have kind of liked me because they had me in again. And that this time Glenn and Les were there. And we, you know, by the end of the long, 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 long day, they'd come up with a story for me to write, and I went and wrote it.
Wow. And you were with Cheers for quite some time. You wrote over 20 episodes, and you wrote, I'd say it's like one of my top three favorite Cheers episodes of the 264 that we made. Dinner at Eight-ish.
Yeah, I love that episode. And that was one of those ones that just everything just came together. And I hate to say it wasn't even really rewritten that much. I mean, I think it was the second or third one with Lilith in it when Fraser,
Sam and Diane go to Lilith and Fraser's for dinner. And it's a very uncomfortable. I mean, that to me was like a great one-act play.
Yeah, no, that was really a wonderful, great experience. Everybody was just top-notch in that. You know, Ted was terrific, Bibi was great, Kelsey was great. They just loved it. They just loved it. It was that. That's my favorite too. But I think I'm number two to you guys.
Yeah,
for writing the most episodes. And and I like to say that I wrote the most episodes of any single writer.
There you go.
since you wrote yours with David Isaacs, of course. But, you know, you guys were with it from the beginning. But the first year that I worked in the business, in those days, you used to freelance your first year.
Yep, there was freelance.
So I did a freelance Cheers, and that was the first one I did. And they called me in to watch the show. I wasn't involved in the production at all, of course. And they called me in to watch. So I was in the audience watching the show, and everything was different. Everything had been rewritten. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. Oh, they must have hated it. Oh, I'm so failed. And then the last scene was kind of the same. And I think the last joke was the same. But I didn't. And in retrospect, I learned that that's a pretty good for a freelance writer, you know.
You bet.
So I went down onto the stage. I considered just sort of slinking out afterward. But I went down on the stage, and everybody was very nice, congratulated me, and all that sort of thing. And I was thinking, why we had to change everything? and then I did a couple of new hearts. And then I did a Mary.
You did a Mary,
that's
right.
Where I first met you, I believe.
Right, when we were doing the series for Mary Tyler Moore, the ill-fated Mary. And the show was canceled before we could do your script. But you did a really nice script.
And I remember
talking to Glenn and Les and saying, you know, we got this really good young guy in here, and they said, "Yeah, we know him. He just did one for us." So there was buzz, buddy.
I guess so. And it was interesting.
And they went, "Which fief was this?"
you had a beard then, and to this day, I always picture you in my mind with a beard. When did you shave off?
You know,
that beard?
I I grew the beard when I was 25, and we were working on MASH, and I wanted to look older.
Because
I'm 25 years old, and I'm giving Harry Morgan notes.
You know? And also beards were kind of fashionable in those days.
Right, right.
As they are again.
And then when I reached 40, I thought to myself, why do I want to look older?
Exactly.
So that's when I cut the beard. And like I looked myself in the mirror, and it was like looking at a different person. Because after 15 years, it's like I was just used to that.
Yeah. But they offered me a job I also did All Is Forgiven.
Okay, and which was... Charles Brothers show, that lasted one season.
And
pretty good show.
It was a good Bess show. It was really good. Carol Kane, Bess Armstrong, about a soap opera, writing a soap opera.
Right,
it's a good idea for a show. Why not? But they offered me a job on that show, and at this point, I had a newborn baby, and I'd made like $30,000 as a freelance writer, and that was more money that I could possibly imagine. I just thought, this is great. And so I thought, I really want to go in every day and work and that sort of thing. I don't want that. Now, the Charles Brothers must have thought, boy, I guess he's holding out for Cheers. That's pretty ballsy of him. Oh, okay, we'll give him an offer of Cheers and see how he does. So the next, and a few months later, they offered me a job on Cheers. And at that point, the agent called me up and said, no, you don't understand, where this will lead, how much this will pay, and all that sort of thing. And I was like, and of course, it was Cheers,
Right.
So I made a really ballsy move out of complete ignorance. Because if I'd gone to All Is Forgiven, of course, the show would have been canceled.
Right, and you'd be off looking for work. Yeah, it's amazing.
I would have kept working, of course, I suppose.
Right, but you might have been on different shows.
Yeah, I wouldn't have had that great credit because, Cheers is a great credit to have. Of course, now it's not, because now when people say Cheers, they expect me to be this ancient, old, doddering, arthritic writer who come in and say, my day, we had laughs. We made real laughs. So I don't mention Cheers a lot in my
really and meetings. And of course, I am older than you, but I do. I'm proud of Cheers. And I'm proud of MASH. I remember watching a 60 Minutes episode talking about ageism and writers, and there was a writer, Bert Prolesky, who said that he no longer put MASH on his resume because it made him appear too old. And I thought to myself, the day I take MASH off of my resume is the day I'll sell ties at Macy's,
Sure, I talk about it with other people. But when I'm in, it went from being, I love Cheers. I love Cheers. It's a great show. I used to watch reruns of Cheers, and I loved it when I was in college. And to, my parents love Cheers. it's never gotten to the point of Cheers? What's that? But, it does seem. And I've had I talk about Boston Legal more than Cheers, let me put it that way. Although even that's receding in the past.
So you moved up through the ranks to where you were one of the showrunners along with Bill and Sherry Steinkellner.
Right.
And when Cheers ended, the three of you decided to team up and make your own show. And you did a series for Bob Newhart.
Yeah, actually, we left before the show ended.
Right.
If I'd known that it was going to be the next year was going to be the last year of the show, I probably wouldn't have left. But nobody knew.
Mm-hmm.
I did a show with Bob Newhart. It was great, great cast: Cynthia Stevenson, Tim Fall, later had Betty White in it, and it was a really good show. Really good show. Didn't last.
Yeah, but boy, what a treat to be working with Bob Newhart.
Well, it was great. I love him, and he's a really nice guy, and real good work ethic, and doesn't want to work too hard.
You mean like to move across a stage?
He used to have a, he was kind of joking where he would, the last, when you'd do the last scene in the run through,
right,
he'd have his car keys in his hand. Because he was ready to go. But he was great. He was great. And you know, I could just hear his voice in my head, and I knew. And every script you wrote, you know, had to be, you know, like 5 pages shorter than any other script because he stammered and hesitated so often.
Right.
But it was all gold. It was all gold. He was great. And, you know, Tom Poston was, you know, guest starred in it and got to know Dick Martin. And it was a wonderful...
You did a series that, a short-lived series on CBS, which I loved, called Thanks.
Yeah,
and it was a show about pilgrims. It was very funny, very novel, and it's always baffled me why period sitcoms have such a tough time breaking through.
Well, I think it's just kind of an odd concept. It was Cloris Leachman and Tim Dutton and Jim Rash was in it, who's since then gone on to do great things. And
won an Oscar.
Kristen Nelson and Erica Christensen. And but it was, you know, it had John Farley was a guest star. Anyway, I think it's just kind of an odd thing. It sort of looks like a sketch when you're doing it. And in that, I mean, there are a few that have been really good over the years that I remembered. I remember the one called Best of the West.
Right.
Ed Weinberg.
Earl Pomerantz.
Earl Pomerantz. obviously, F Troop was successful, I suppose. In England, The Blackadder was a great success and a really good show. And these were the shows that we were sort of modeling after, Best of the West and Blackadder. And, you know, the idea was you would do a family sitcom, but they're the pilgrims and they're living in the edge of starvation and the Indians are around and
they don't understand germs.
And they don't
sort of
understand
thing.
Germs. Yeah. And they don't understand that tobacco will kill you. And there was a great scene, that Jim Rash did, where he comes in to rob the general store, and he tries to load the musket, and it takes him about 5 minutes to load the musket. So he's putting it in. There's great physical humor, and it was a really wonderful show. I personally don't feel that it's a tragedy that the show was canceled after 6 episodes, or we only did 6 episodes. My idea is, I'm amazed that they let us do 6 episodes. I was amazed that they let us shoot the pilot. I was amazed. It was the only time I've ever not gotten notes, because they couldn't figure out how to give us notes, because the show is so weird that they just sort of let us do what we wanted to do, me and Mark Ligon. It was a glorious experience. And the good thing about shows that only last a short period of time is that they never have a time to go bad on you, you know? You get along great with the cast. You get along great. You're friends with them forever and all that, because, you know, it's usually around year 3 that they start to turn on you, you know? And if you only do shows that run for, you know, half a season or season and a half, you know, it's all roses and sunshine, you know?
That's right. Well... on the other hand, I'm going to talk about your experience with a show called Coupling.
Yeah.
And Coupling was a show that was done in England by Stephen Moffat, great writer, also did Doctor Who, the new Sherlock series that you
good,
see.
Good friend of mine.
You know, brilliant, brilliant writer. And it was kind of an edgier version of Friends with a great cast, really funny. And then NBC, because this was the era of Friends, NBC decided to make an American version of it. And they were going to basically use Stephen's scripts, but they put you in charge of it. And I thought, boy, this is like the perfect marriage. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, I was so excited about this. And it almost, when I watched the TV series episodes... I kind of think of this.
Right.
Explain a little bit about what went wrong.
They Stephen Moffat and his wife Sue Virtue, who's a wonderful, great, great writer, and she's a terrific lady, they had been through they had shot a previous pilot of Coupling before with a different showrunner and different cast, and then they and he was very involved in that. And I think in England, I don't know, is it different or what it is, or he's just a really angry Scotsman, but he basically was thrown out of the country. he basically couldn't be in the room with a network executive, everything. So I used to talk to him all the time on the phone, and I'd see him, but basically he didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I felt it was like, you know, if you do an American, there's a play that has been a big hit in the West End, and then you're doing the American version of it. You're doing it on Broadway. And so I thought, you know, you kind of do it the same. And the scripts had to be cut somewhat because their half an hour scripts are actually a half an hour, whereas ours are like 22 right. minutes. But other than that, and I don't know, I mean,
the casting. You know, it seemed to me, whereas the British version went for the best possible actors, the funniest actors, the most real actors, and the U.S. version was just pretty people.
Well, they were pretty people in England too. They were very attractive people in England.
Some of them.
I don't know. I mean, if you look at that cast, every one of those actors has gone on to do great things. I don't think they were that bad. I personally don't think the show was.
Did you get a lot of notes from NBC?
Oh yeah, no. I get tons of notes from NBC, tons of notes from the studio, tons of notes from the pod. I mean, it was that era when. Which is still going on, when you're spending all the time trying to diffuse the notes, trying to get the notes out of there, trying to do that, you know. And there's very little time can be spent actually doing the show that you want to do. So that's actually one of the reasons why I don't like to do multi-camera anymore, because, you know, on a one-camera show, they give you notes at the table read, and they can give you a ton of notes at the table read, but that's the last time they
right.
see it.
Then they go away. Yeah.
On a multi-camera show, they see it like three or four times, and every time they can say, "I don't understand. Why do you call him Curly if he is bald?" and all the jokes just get mushed and flattened, and you know, when they would come in and argue about the color of the wall set. The color of the paint on the wall, and I would think, oh great, let them argue about that, because then they're not paying attention to the other stuff. But the costumes, everything. I mean, they were just in everything, and so you never really had a chance to do the show that you wanted to do. But you know, very talented writers who've all gone on to do great things or did great things. Very talented cast. It just, you know, sometimes the magic works and sometimes it doesn't.
So you transitioned into screenplays. You wrote Mrs. Winterbourne. Mm-hmm. How did you make that transition?
It was after the Bob Newhart show before then. I just wanted to try and do as many different things as I can do. That's always been my goal, you know, to keep myself interested and to keep it... keep the juices flowing. I didn't really think of it in terms of you know, furthering my career and all that. I just, you know, I'd always wanted to write a screenplay. So I wrote a spec screenplay and got, you know, interest and people looked at it and all that. And then I got hired to do Mrs. Winterbourne, and right after that I got hired to do The Fan.
Now, The Fan was a Robert De Niro movie.
Right.
That was... just crushed by critics, and it wasn't very good. It wasn't a very good movie. But in fairness, I remember you telling me the story that once you turned in your draft, the phone stopped ringing, as William Goldman used to say, and other writers were brought in.
I was the first writer. It was based on a book. It was based on a novel. I was the first writer who wrote, you know, the first screenplay. I wrote a couple of screenplays, you know. And at that point, you're the star. You know, the studio's calling you. The network's calling you. I mean, not the network, but the producer's calling you. Everybody's calling you. You know, you feel like you're the focus of everything, you know.
Right.
And I wrote it pretty quickly, man, but in about a year. You know, I did a number of drafts, but I did it in about a year. And it was, by God, they were going to make it. And they were talking about directors, and they were talking about that. For a while, Mike Newell was going to direct it, and he and I got along great.
Uh-huh.
And my version of it was more of a sort of a satire of the star and the fan relationship and all that, and there was more humor in it. But then he dropped out. And then they hired Tony Scott to direct it, and Wesley Snipes. Wesley Snipes isn't really right for this part because this guy's supposed to be, you know, basically a baseball star who's never had anything go wrong in his life. You know, just, you know, it could have been Denzel Washington or somebody, but, you know, a guy where this is the first time he's ever had a problem. And Wesley Snipes, you know, is a good actor, but he looks like he's come up from the streets and he's had a lot of problems,
right,
you know.
Right.
So that was, and then the De Niro, and yeah. Far be it for me to object to Robert De Niro being cast, but I mean, he's played psychos before, you know,
uh-huh.
And this was supposed to be a obsessive fan. And it was like, well, God, you know, he did it in King of Comedy, he did it in Taxi Driver. I mean, he's done this. Tony Scott actually wanted to get Johnny Depp, and this was before Johnny Depp was
Johnny Depp
as respected an actor as it was, and they didn't want to do it. He would have been good. But still, you know, still when I looked at the, I thought, well, you know, they got Tony Scott, they got Robert De Niro, they got Wesley Snipes. I must have done a really good job. And then the first thing they do is they fire me, or they discontinued my work on it, and they hire, I believe it was Frank Darabont to rewrite it. So I mean, you can't object to that too, because
right.
That's a big name. And so I'm gonna think about that. Then I get a call, and they're going into production, and they need production rewrites. And they want to hire me to do production rewrites. So I'm rewriting somebody's rewritten version of what I wrote. And the characters, of course, are completely different. And I don't know what the hell the characters are. And they're flying me up to San Francisco, and I'm putting me in a closet and having me write stuff on the set and flying me down to Anaheim where they film the baseball stuff. And, of course, Tony Scott... tragic end, but he was a nut. I mean, he was a enthusiastic nut. He always wore the same red cap and red vest and short shorts, and he was fucking great. And everybody used to. He had this whole idea that at the end of the climactic end of the last baseball game, the climactic end of it, there'd be pouring rain.
Right.
You know, and everybody's trying to. You know, they.
They stopped the games.
They call baseball games when it rains. They don't do that. No, it'll be fucking great. It'll be fucking great, man. And he'd call you when he was, you know, mountain climbing and, you know, giving you notes and all that stuff. And so, yeah, you know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And then I went to the screening, to the premiere of the show. And, you know, and it was not very good. You know, and it was not only that, there was like one scene that I'd really written, because at various times, like for instance, they went and they told me when I was doing the rewrites, they told me, you know, we want this show to get a PG-13, so you can't say fuck more than twice, okay?
Uh huh.
And so I go through the script. Oh God, that's right. So I go through the script and I pick the two fucks that are the most important to the script. Okay. And I guess I must have spent a day doing that. Oh, I'm going. Cut to Robert De Niro, who is ad libbing constantly. Well, fuck this. What the fuck are you doing? What the fuck is this? And I think I just want that day back. I just want that day back. Because anyway, but there was only like one scene that was bore any remote resemblance to what I wrote. But my name was on there because Frank Darabont didn't want his name on it. So my name was there, written by Phoebe Sutton. And it was not very good, and it didn't do very well. And however, I will say since then, you know, it's funny, as enough time passes and people will see it on TV now and they won't be aware that it was a bomb. And I get a lot of people liking it now. You know, uh-huh. A lot of people saying, yeah, it's a good movie. Oh, that's a good movie.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I don't get that with Mannequin 2.
Do you get that with Volunteers? I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, no, we do.
We do get that
with Volunteers.
Yeah.
But I was happy with Volunteers.
And Mrs. Winterbourne, too. It was a good experience.
Was I right? Great guest. Phoebe Sutton. That was part one
of our two-part interview. Next week, we're going to talk about his transition to TV drama, also a very serious health scare that he had, and then his life as a novelist. We'll also talk about his writing process, some advice for young writers. Part two is every bit as good as part one. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. And as always, our thanks to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, and Randy Thomas. You can follow me on Twitter at Ken Levine. Also, if you have any comments or questions, I am available via email, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Once again, that's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Come back next week for part two of my interview with Thief Sutton. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Hollywood and
Levine. Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader, too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.